This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
I don't need to wait another minute, let alone an hour, to take common sense steps that will save the lives in the future and to urge my colleagues in the House and Senate to act. We can ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines in this country once again.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, well, good afternoon and welcome. It is good to be with you today. Thanks for joining me. That was Joe Biden, of course, and let's just say President Biden. He is our president right now, and those were his own words, of course, talking about guns and banning assault weapons. And we could talk about that coming up in a moment. Let me just, before I we get into any of the news today, just remind you, Roma Downey is going to be stopping by the show a little bit later. There's a new movie out. And right after the Chapel, I'll speak to her. You might remember her. She was in Touched by the Angel. She and her husband, very gifted producers. They really use their craft and their gifts to advance the message of Christianity. And I love that about her. So she's going to be here. I'm going to fill you in on a movie you might want to check out and see. And we got a lot of other fun stuff happening a little bit later in the show today. So hang out. If you miss anything, always go to my archives. Okay? You can go to the podcasts. In fact, I would share these podcasts with others. You might say, hey, I missed that, but I'd love to hear that. I love, you know, Roma Downey. Or, hey, I love that conversation you had with that epidemiologist. Or, wow, that was fascinating on the afterlife. Relevantradio.com. Just find my show, and you'll find several months' worth of those podcasts. And we spoke to an exorcist yesterday, which I thought was kind of an interesting conversation. It was a fun conversation, an enlightening conversation. So you can check that out. That was right after the chaplain. We also spoke and we prayed yesterday for what happened in Boulder, Colorado. And such a tragedy when you see these things happen. We had that horrific shooting in Atlanta the week before. And, of course, the president, as you just heard, is called for Congress to pass legislation that would ban he wants to ban so-called assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And I don't know where you are on that issue. You might say, hey, I'm all for that. He also asked the Senate to pass legislation from the House that would close loopholes on background checks. So take a listen to the president in his own words as he makes the call to ban assault weapons.
I don't need to wait another minute, let alone an hour, to take common sense steps that will save the lives in the future and to urge my colleagues in the House and Senate to act. We can ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines in this country once again. I got that done when I was a senator. It passed. It was law for the longest time. And it brought down these mass killings. We should do it again. We can close the loopholes in our background check system, including the Charleston loophole. That's one of the best tools we have right now to prevent gun violence. The Senate should immediately pass. Let me say it again. The United States Senate, I hope some are listening, should immediately pass the two House-passed bills that close loopholes in the background check system. These are bills that receive votes of both Republicans and Democrats in the House. This is not and should not be a partisan issue. This is an American issue. It will save lives, American lives. And we have to act. We should also ban assault weapons in the process.
All right. That's the president. His spokeswoman, Jen Psaki, told reporters yesterday, look, we're considering a range of levers, is the word she used, including working through legislation, including executive action. And that's been under discussion and will continue to be under discussion. She didn't specify what that would be. See, the thing about executive actions, they can be overturned with the next president. I heard the vice president, Kamala Harris, say, you know, we need to do this legislatively. And that's what they're looking to do right now. We'll see what happens. This is an issue that will not go away, I think, in the days ahead. Something you're going to hear a lot about. I'll try to give you a perspective on it and keep you informed. The Archbishop of Oklahoma City, Archbishop Paul Coakley, he issued a statement on behalf of the Conference of U.S. Bishops. He said this regarding gun control. So you're probably saying, well, what's the church's position on this? How do they view it? Here's what Bishop Coakley said. He says, the bishops have long promoted prudent measures of gun control to limit mass shootings and other gun homicides and suicide, and we stand by those positions. End of quote. So he referenced in the statement that he made, a talk that was given by Bishop Frank DeWayne to the USCCB on gun violence in our country. At the time, Bishop DeWayne stated that that bishops supported a ban on assault weapons. They supported universal background checks, federal gun trafficking bill, regulations on the sale of handguns. They supported improved mental health interventions and really an honest assessment of violent images and experiences in our society. One final thing they said, too, he says that he also supports extreme risk protection orders or red flag laws and licensing of handguns. So that was the USCCB in the country, and that's where they stand. So we'll see how all this shakes out. The Senate today, they started on the hearings it was H.R. 1, For the People Act is what this one was called. And what that does is it revolutionizes the way we vote in our country. And it is a gorilla of a bill. I'm telling you, it's 800 pages. And it's being opposed by a lot of conservatives. But it's also even being conserved by liberals because they see some of the provisions are actually unconstitutional. The ACLU is opposing this as well. And you know how liberal they can be. But the bill would remove the authority over elections from states and just give it to the federal government. And our Constitution does not allow that. So it puts your money, it puts taxpayer funding into politicians' coffers by a 6-to-1 match in taxpayer dollars to their campaign. So I'll translate that. What does that mean? It means if a person can give, let's say, $100 to a campaign, well, the government would then give $600 to that same campaign. So whether you want your tax money going to the candidate or not, it would go to that candidate. You know, and the bill would also interfere with the ability of states and citizens to determine qualifications for voters and assure the accuracy of voter registration rolls. I don't like it personally. I don't think it's a good idea. There's a whole lot of other things that are wrong with it as well. Again, I'm putting this on your radar. I don't want to drill down into it now. I know we've talked about the vote a lot over the years, over the months, I should say, over recent days. So just something to continue to track for you. Democrats, according to thehill.com, are seeking ways around the filibuster, right? And, you know, Republicans are going to, you know, put on the bill, including changing rules that there is no filibuster. So that's a whole nother issue. And we'll talk about that coming up in a minute here, too. You know, D.C.'s moving towards statehood, the filibuster. What's happening? What's going to happen here in our country? So a lot that will impact the country, the states, and a whole lot of other things. But so White House officials, and one other note here, they joined members of Congress today in making a trip to the southern border. And they want to see what's happening down there. We talked about immigration the other day. The White House is going to allow one video camera into the facility. And I mentioned this the other day because I don't like the idea of a media blackout. The Biden administration has not permitted any video, any cameras down into these facilities. And I'm thinking, well, why not? What about freedom of the press, right? Okay, they're going to allow one video camera now into the facility. They were hit hard earlier this week for not allowing the press in to these hastily constructed facilities. And again, it's all political optics. That's what this is all about. You know, it's about the narrative and it's about the message. It's about the imaging. So great. Now we got a camera in here. So the border right now is a disaster, to be honest. Even the Today Show admitted that. I saw this report, and I'll share it with you. Listen to this.
This morning at the southern border, more than 15,000 migrant children are in federal custody, and the Homeland Security Secretary is trying to contain the fallout.
The border is closed. We are expelling families. We are expelling single adults, and we've made a decision that we will not expel young, vulnerable children.
Now, a new temporary overflow facility for up to 2,000 children is set to open in West Texas. While the Biden administration claims the surge is on pace to be the largest in 20 years, Republicans are pouncing.
The border right now is wide open because the Biden administration dismantled the very effective policies of the Trump administration.
We visited a shelter in Matamoros, Mexico, where Janine Torres told us she was desperate.
Es muy desesperante tener a tus hijos.
As a mother, we want the best for our kids, she said.
Right now, there are about 80 or so migrants in this shelter. Some have been waiting for asylum for more than a year.
In El Paso, Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut toured border facilities. Hundreds of kids packed into big open rooms, he tweeted. I fought back tears as a 13-year-old girl sobbed uncontrollably, explaining to a translator how terrified she was.
I know a lot of foster parents are intervening for those kids, too, which is really good news. I thought about it, too. You know, So many children down there, you know, being away from family and parents and so many people. It's a tough situation. I saw Representative Dan Crenshaw of Texas. I'm sure you're familiar with him. He's a Republican. And he also sounded off on the border problem. And he actually went on MSNBC, right? You go talk about going into the lion's den. Listen to what he said.
Look, in February, we had over 100,000 crossings. Back in November, there was about 800 people in CBP custody. Now there's about 10,000. Migrants will tell you, as reporters are interviewing them, that the Joe Biden invited them. The drug cartels are passing this information along. Look, there was very specific policies that were reversed as soon as Biden took office. As you mentioned, that I said in our Twitter exchange, remain in Mexico policy, and really importantly, the asylum cooperative agreements with Northern Triangle countries. This basically reinstates a process of catch and release. When people think that they're going to come across the border as long as they have a child with them and they're going to be released, then that's a huge incentive to come across, especially when they're going to get a bus ticket wherever they want and now a hotel room because that's what's being funded. So the incentives are pretty obvious, and we have to ask ourselves the question, is this a sustainable policy? And is this fair to millions and millions of people around the world who have valid asylum claims that now are getting clogged into the system and can't get their claims heard?
All right. And again, that was a couple days ago, just to give you some perspective on that. Look, let's pray for the situation on the border. You know Selena Zito, right? She's a frequent guest here on the program here. She reported on Bruno Lozano. He's the mayor of Del Rio, Texas, who says that this crisis, it's a humanitarian crisis is what it is on his border. It's alarming. It's growing rapidly. And look, as a Catholic, my heart goes out to migrants. It does. And I at the same time, I love my country. I believe we have a sovereign right to defend our borders, and there should be orderly immigration. And he says, though, this the mayor of Del Rio, Texas, he says, look, it's becoming a problem for the citizens on the border. The blind eye that the administration has taken, has turned towards this, and all of those who live on the border towns, he says is wrong. That there's no news yet of whether or not President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are planning a trip down there to see themselves. I hope they do. So Vice President Harris, she actually scoffed and then laughed. You ever notice that? She kind of laughs after she makes her comments. She first scoffed, then she kind of cackled a little bit and laughed off the question the other day when a reporter asked if she planned to go to the border, right? She planned to go to the border. She seemed to also, in this clip, and I'll play it for her, she seemed to blame the problem on the previous administration. Listen.
Do you plan to visit the border?
Not today. But I have before, and I'm sure I will again. Yeah.
Well, Marquez, on the border,
there's obviously a lot of political pressure coming from Republicans in particular on this administration, but also some of the Democrats who represent some of those border districts. What can the administration do, at least in the short term, to kind of assure people that it's really taking steps to make sure that the children in particular, are being treated humanely, but also that you're sort of, you know, thinking about the bigger picture weeks and months ahead?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, we were left with a very challenging situation. And you know, let me start by saying I think we all agree, and Secretary Mayorkas said it a number of times this weekend, let's get these kids out of CBP custody, get them into HHS custody. We've got to treat this issue in a way that is reflective of our values as Americans and do it in a way that is fair and it is humane. But we have to meet the moment, and there's a lot of work going into that, and we expect to have success, but it's going to take a lot of work.
All right, that's the vice president there, just keeping you abreast of all that is unfolding there on the board. A lot going on in the country, isn't there? You know, from H.R. 1 to the Equality Act to guns to assault weapons to the southern border. There's something else that's, I think, pretty big that's looming that I just want to put on your radar so you're in the know on this. On Monday, the House Oversight Committee held a hearing on a bill that would make Washington, D.C. the 51st state. You heard me right. The 51st state in the union. How's that sound? Ring well? Listen to what CNN was reporting just a few days ago.
The House Oversight Committee is holding a hearing on whether Washington, D.C. should become the country's 51st state. Among those testifying today is the mayor of D.C., Muriel Bowser. House Democrats passed a bill last year to make the district a state, but that bill never reached the then-Republican-controlled Senate. Republicans strongly oppose statehood and would likely use the filibuster to try and block this. D.C.'s shadow senator, Paul Strauss, is joining us now to talk about this.
Well, it is step one, but it's an important step. We expect the House Committee will report the bill favorably, and then the House will then pass it. The battle will then shift to the United States Senate, where its companion bill, S-51, has a record number of co-sponsors, including 41 senators that are currently on record as co-sponsoring, not just voting or supporting, but co-sponsoring the bill.
So Democratic Congresswoman Eleanor Norton, she's from North Carolina. She went head-to-head with a Republican Congressman James Comer of Kentucky. And as Congresswoman Norton made the case for D.C. and its statehood, the congressman argued against the idea. Listen to this.
Congress can no longer allow D.C. residents to be sidelined in the democratic process. Watching as Congress votes on matters that affect the nation with no say of their own, or watching as Congress votes to overturn the laws of the duly elected D.C. Council with no say of their own.
Today's hearing is all about creating two new Democratic U.S. Senate seats. D.C. statehood is a key part of the radical leftist agenda to reshape America, along with the Green New Deal, yep, defunding the police, and packing the U.S. Supreme Court.
There you have it. I'm joined right now by Zach Smith. He's a legal fellow in the Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. You can check him out at heritage.org. Mr. Smith, welcome. It's good to have you here. Good afternoon.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank
you. I really appreciate it.
It's good to talk with you. This is, you know, I'd love to talk about Puerto Rico too, but let's talk D.C. What's the current law right now, for those who don't know, about Washington, D.C.'s status?
Well, Washington, D.C. has unique status in our country. It's a status that was envisioned by the founding fathers, by the framers of the Constitution, that it wouldn't be a part of any state, that it would be neutral territory where the congressmen and women and the senators from each state could come to have national policy debates on neutral ground. It's a federal entity, as the founding fathers envisioned, so that the federal government would be in control of the physical security of the Capitol, and also so that no one state would dominate the national discussion, right, by the fact that the national capital would be there. And so, you know, there are very significant constitutional questions, which interestingly, a lot of folks did not engage in a discussion, right, with at the hearing on Monday. But there are very good practical reasons why the district should not become a state. And most importantly, you know, it was really the intent of our founding fathers that the district would not be a state. And so if that is going to change, a constitutional amendment would be required to accomplish it.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but aren't there some serious questions that the residents of Washington, D.C. raise about their proper representation in Congress, about the veto power Congress has over the city council? How does all that work?
So in the 1970s, district residents were granted something called home rule. They were able to elect the city council, elect their own mayor, right, have more control over their finances, that sort of thing. But again, you know, even those who support D.C. statehood, who support the district getting two senators and representatives in the House, you know, recognize that the founding fathers clearly did not intend to have senators or voting representatives in Congress. And they viewed it as a trade-off because district residents would be so close to the seat of government, be able to, lobby many members of Congress, many members of the executive branch, that they would be able to exert influence, protect their own interests in that manner, and really be represented by the Congress as a whole. Right. Now, you know, there are very good arguments whether that has, in fact, played out or not. Right. But again, it goes back to the point, if you think the reasons that the framers did not provide voting representation, right, in Congress to the district are no longer true, The way to change that is through an amendment to our Constitution, right, not through simple legislation, as H.R. 51 proposes to do.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Right now, my understanding is if you live there, you can vote, but you don't have a vote in Congress. And there's a delegate to Congress, but the person who holds that office doesn't have a vote. And votes in the city council can be overturned by Congress. But yeah, my understanding is that the Democrats who are really pushing for this are pushing for it because the vast majority of those who live there are minorities, and then they will vote overwhelmingly Democratic. Is that the case? They'll vote Democrat?
Yeah, the district heavily leans very Democratic. It's a very liberal city, no yeah. question about it. And it certainly seems that the push for D.C. statehood at this time in this way is because it's viewed as being politically advantageous. You know, back in the 70s, an attempt was made to give district residents representation in the Senate, representation in the House through a constitutional amendment, and it failed. Not enough states ratified it in the prescribed period of time. And so I suspect the reason we're seeing this push in H.R. 51 to do this by legislation right. is because getting a constitutional amendment passed is a much more yeah. difficult task.
Well, I'll tell you what, do you have a minute? I'd love to talk to you about Puerto Rico, too, but I got to take a quick break here.
Sure.
So when we come back, let's do that. There's another place, if you're just joining me, that's considered for statehood. And it's Puerto Rico. And right now, you know, the island is an unincorporated territory of the United States. I'll tell you what's being proposed there. So you got D.C., now Puerto Rico. Stay with us. Our conversation continues. Plus, I got some good news I want to share with you on the other side. Stay with me.
Do you know what the doxology is? Hi, this is Father Rocky with our 31st lesson on the Mass. No matter which Eucharistic prayer we use, they all end the same with the Eucharistic doxology. A doxology is the English translation of a Greek word, which means a short hymn of praise to God. The priest proclaims, "Through him, with him, in him, in the unity of the Holy Spirit, all glory and honor is yours, Almighty Father, forever and ever," as he raises the Eucharistic Lord in the consecrated host and in the precious blood in the sacred chalice for the entire congregation to see and ponder. Who is the hymn in this hymn of praise? Jesus Christ, of course. So this short prayer is a Trinitarian formula of praise to God the Father through Christ, with Christ and in Christ, in union with the Holy Spirit. There's a lot going on at Mass, isn't there? Prayer is one of the pillars of Lent, and the Mass is the greatest prayer of all. Please join me for Mass weekdays at noon Central.
And join us for Class After Mass. It's The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Insight and analysis right here. It's The Drew Mariani Show. Relevant Radio.
Taking a look at all that is changing here in the country, trying to give you a perspective on it. Quite often I try to give you that moral perspective. And today we're taking a look at possibly some additional states to the Union. What do you think about that? Puerto Rico, if it became a state, would be the 31st most populous state. And just as a side note, I want to thank Patrick Alog, my producer here, who pointed out to me that D.C. actually has more people than two other states, Vermont and Wyoming. So Jake put up a Twitter poll. You can check it out if you want to sound off. Should D.C. Become a state? I'm talking this afternoon with Zach Smith. He's a legal fellow in the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. And when we left off, we talked about D.C., but you may not be aware that statehood is being considered right now for Puerto Rico. Right now, the island, as I was sharing, is an unincorporated territory of the states. And last November, the residents there, they passed a resolution very narrowly. It was 52-48% to seek statehood. And this question has come up a lot of times. Most of the time, it's been rejected by voters. But 4 years ago, the question won. In fact, it won decisively. But only 23% of the electorate showed up to vote at the time. So Democrats in the House have now introduced the Puerto Rico Self-Determination Act of 2021, which empowers the territory to reexamine its status and association with our country, with the United States, and they're establishing a delegation right now of Puerto Rican voters, I should say. And what the bill's authors say is that it would give the delegation the choice of considering statehood. And once again, this is something I know the Democrats are pushing for. They could see that island again would be would vote primarily for them. Not that that's forever. Things change, right? But this is a little bit different than you know how the framers posed and wanted to look at D.C. And I'm joined today by Zach Smith. We were talking about that during the break. And Zach, there is a distinction here, isn't it? Statehood for D.C. is a little bit different than statehood for Puerto Rico.
Yes, absolutely. Puerto Rico, if it wanted to become a state, would be subject to the same process that 37 other states have previously used to join our you know, federal union. And so, you know, it'd come in Article 4, Section 3, the admissions clause of the Constitution would govern that process. Again, though, the district is unique for several reasons, you know, and constitutionally speaking, it's unique because it owes its existence to a separate federal constitutional provision, the district clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, and also because the district is subject to the 23rd Amendment, which says that the district constituting the seat of government shall appoint presidential and vice presidential electors. And so Puerto Rico would certainly not be subjected to those same constitutional constraints. And also many of the arguments about the need to have a, you know, a separate federal enclave to be the seat of the federal government, the intent of the founding fathers with regard to that seat of government, all of those really would not apply to Puerto Rico becoming a state because, again, those are unique to the District of Columbia.
Well, let's take a call or two, too. If you want to join us, 888-914-9149. I only have Zach Smith for a few minutes here. And Zach, Rob is in San Diego. He's got a point he wants to bring up with you. Rob, good afternoon. You are on the air.
Good afternoon. Thanks. Yeah, I firmly oppose these two statehood efforts. They're clearly power grabs. The Democrats don't care about constitutional this or that. I mean, these are the same people trying to abolish the Electoral College, so I don't care what they say. Their arguments are bogus. They know D.C. is a guaranteed two Democrat senators. Puerto Rico is likely to. The only way I would support it is if we carved up part of large Democrat states like maybe New York, Oregon, or Washington and created several states to balance them out. Then I'd support it. But, you know, they're not going to do that either because this is a power grab. So I just strictly oppose it. And anyone with common sense should oppose it.
Thanks. I appreciate the call. And I'll let you respond to him, Zach, if you'd like to. Your thoughts.
Sure. Well, I think you actually bring up a good point, Rob, because one of the things that Article 4, Section 3, the Admissions Clause says is that no state or part of a state can be carved up to create a new state without the original state's consent. And so another issue that revolves around D.C. statehood is that the state of Maryland, which donated the land that the current district sits on, donated it to the federal government for the purposes of creating a federal seat of government. And so, you know, it seems obvious that at the time Maryland donated the land, they would not have been okay with the federal government immediately turning around and creating a new state out of that land. And so just because time has since then, that doesn't mean what you couldn't do originally, you can do now, just because of the passage of time.
It's such a great point. If you go back historically and you look, if I was part of that state and I gave up, you know, territory, would I want another state made out of it? No, of course not. So, you know, that's such a great point. The state of California, you know, if I remember correctly, there have been statehood movements in central California. I think six Californians have proposed initiatives to split that state into, I think it was six different parts. I talked about this a couple of years ago, I think. It failed to qualify as on the California ballot. There was a measure, I think, in 2016. Are we seeing this in other states around the union, too? And how likely is it that, final thoughts here, that we will see Puerto Rico or D.C. become states or any other state break up into smaller states?
Well, there's not currently a bill in the Congress to make Puerto Rico a state right now. So that isn't, it may be coming down the pipeline, but it's certainly not presently before the Congress right now. This D.C. statehood bill, H.R. 51, the almost identical bill passed the House last year. It's probably going to pass the House of Representatives again this year. And so, again, the question will become, what's the Senate going to do? And, of course, this gets tied into the debate on the filibuster. If the filibuster holds, you know, obviously D.C. statehood by simple legislation becomes a much tougher thing to achieve. And so, you know, I think it's really important that senators like Joe Manchin, Kirsten Sinema, that they stay true to their word, that they uphold the filibuster, recognize the importance of it, and won't try to radically, you know, redefine the structure of our government, you know, in constitutionally questionable manners.
Amen to that. I often say votes have consequences. I mean, look how close. You know, it comes down to now one or two senators. It's pretty crazy. Hey, thank you for your time and for your insight. If people want to follow you or read the writing, I know the Heritage Foundation is such a great resource, but what's the best way to get connected to you?
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter at TZ Smith, at TZ Smith. Certainly have been getting a lot of angry tweets after my testimony earlier this week, which is okay to be expected.
Yeah.
So you can certainly follow me on Twitter, or if you go to heritage.org, you can follow me there and see everything that my colleagues and I are writing on this and many other topics as well.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Keep your wonderful work up. I appreciate the rationality and the sanity. So look forward to talking to you again. Thanks for being here.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me on. Take care.
All right. And Jake, you put up a Twitter poll here too, right? How are we doing on that?
Well, the question on our Twitter was, should Washington, D.C. be given statehood status? And a whopping 89%, Drew, are saying no, they should not. Now, I also should point out here that it's not the remaining 11% saying yes, they should. 5.6% are saying yes, and then the other 5.6% are saying they don't even care. So even less people saying they want D.C. to be given statehood status. But you can give us your thoughts on our Twitter page. It's at Drew Mariani Show.
Yeah, please follow us there. I mean, you can follow the show at Drew Mariani Show. If you want to follow me personally, at Drew Mariani. I'm not the best on Twitter. I mean, Jake does a great job with the show page and Facebook, but I do pop on every once in a while to give you some great information, and I really should be more more proactive. I'd love to have you follow me there, and then we can communicate when we are off the air here, okay? At Drew Mariani Show. Just do a search, you'll find me, okay? It'd be great. Facebook, too, you can find us there. When I come back, I want to share some good news with you, okay? I was thinking about this. I was, you know, I was praying the other day, actually. I was in prayer, and I was praying for our country. You know, we see the alliance now forming between Russia and China on the international front. We see the breakdown of talks in Alaska. You know, we see the discontent in our nation. We see the separation of families. We see the crises that we're having, not just from the pandemic, but economically for so many people. We see the moral threats that face us today. See the equality. So much that's going on today. I was really asking God for mercy on our country. I was really, really begging him for that. And I just, you know, you see all the news, it's so bad. I came across a report, and I'll share this when I come back, that showed that prayer does work, that things are changing. There's some good news out there, and I want to share a little bit of good news with you. I mean, so often we talk about these other issues, you're thinking, oh, it's so horrible. There is some good news. Look, good always conquers evil. In the end, we win. We know how the story ends, right? We know Our Lady crushes the head. Go back to Genesis, right? We know what happens. What did Our Lady say in Fatima? In the end, my immaculate heart will triumph. So have hope. When things look dark, it's often darkest before the dawn. There are brighter days coming for this country. There are brighter days coming for your future. I believe that. We just have to be faithful. We really do. I'll share with you this story. But before I take my break, just a quick side note for you, too. The book Divine Mercy, and we're going to pray the chaplet in about 20 minutes here. Is out, overwhelming response to it. And I'm so grateful for everyone who said, Drew, I'd love to read what you wrote. This is a compilation of a lot of what I know. I mean, I was limited to about 140 pages, so maybe I'll throw some other tidbits out to you in the future, but this is going to be a great introduction. It's a 101 for you into divine mercy. I talk about everything from the mercy of God to the importance of trust to the life of Faustina and Sapochko to the great spiritual treasures heaven has given to us to the afterlife. Faustina even wrote about the chambers of hell. I mean, we talk about prayer and what Faustina said about souls that pray. And it's really interesting if you pray or if you don't pray, what happens to the soul. I put some of that in there. I mean, there's so much stuff that you're just going to love it. And the book's free. So just want to remind you because we have limited quantities and this campaign is going to end soon. It is going to end soon. Jake just told me he also linked it up on our Twitter. So if you just went there and followed us, you'll see it at the top of the page. The book is called Divine Mercy. You can go to relevantradio.com. You can go to my Twitter page or you use your mobile app and it's free. All right. So you could do yourself a favor and tell somebody else to sign up for it, and then get your sibling or your coworker or your neighbor or somebody at church or whatever. Say, why don't you get this? It's free. We're going to even pay for the shipping and handling. So there's no strings attached. It won't cost you a penny. Sign up, and it is yours. All right? It's absolutely yours. Completely, completely free. And the reason I encourage you to tell one other person is because St. Faustina promised that anybody who promotes the message of mercy, that's why I'm so passionate about it, that you would receive divine protection. You would get protection. The Lord said, that soul will be protected like an infant by her tender mother. I love it. And also promised that you will shine with a special brilliance in the next life. So there's a lot of benefit for promoting mercy. That's why I was willing to say, yeah, look, let's give the book away free. Yeah, Relevant, thanks for getting it into the hands of everybody. Thanks for paying for it. So it's yours, and it's our gift to you. So please take advantage of it, okay? RelevantRadio.com, and just sign up for it, all right? And tell others. That's really the key. Use your social media. Do a tweet. Do an email blast. Put it on your Facebook. Make others aware of it. All right, short break. When we come back, Dr. Michael New will be stopping by. There is some good news that I want to share. I mean, things are not as dark in the country as you think. And here's one of the indicators. I'll share that with you when I return.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Connect with Drew on the Relevant Radio app.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app.
Now that's a classic bumper. Thanks, Jake. Hey, good afternoon. Great to be with you. The chaplain's coming up in about 15 minutes. Let me share a little bit of good news, right? You know, if you look at the news, you can get pretty depressed, right? There's a lot of negativity out there. And this culture of death seems to predominate on so many different levels. The whole pro-abortion lobby would have you out there believing that, you know, abortions are just, well, they become, you know, normal. They're accepted by American society. And they want you to believe that. We keep getting ads and all these publicity campaigns telling us that abortion is freedom. It's normal. It's a way of life. One columnist had what looked like a public breakdown not long ago because a certain show that she was watching had a character who didn't want to go through an abortion. How horrible. Can you believe that? Instead, this person decided to carry the baby to term. So it might be that, look, all of that pressure being applied on our society to accept, you know, the destruction of innocent children, unborn children, is not working. In fact, I think it's backfiring. And I've often said this. You and I are on the right side of history. We'll look back on this chapter. There'll be future generations that say, I can't believe slavery was ever permitted in the country. How could anybody think that was right? They're going to think the same thing about abortion. Right now, there's a tremendous darkening of the intellect, a blindness that is happening. People who promote this must not be able to see it because it lacks complete rationality. The Guttmacher Institute is the statistical research branch of the pro-abortion movement. And they come out with some comprehensive data on abortions, on the numbers since 1980. And what they found is not what Planned Parenthood and their ilk want to see happen, but here's what they're reporting. Between 1980 and 2017, the abortion rate for 15 to 19-year-olds, right, it fell. Listen to this number. This is good news. We should rejoice in this. The abortion rates between girls who are 15 and 19 fell by 82%. 82%! That's amazing. The abortion rate for those 35 to 39, it fell by 8.5% during the same period. So we see this on a decline. The percentage of pregnancies carried to term by those teenagers, it increased by more than 10 percentage points. So that's awesome. You might think that the culture of death is winning. It's not. It's not. I know attitudes are changing. As I said, you and I are on the right side of history, on the right side of life. So what's causing this to happen? Well, Guttmacher and its secular allies want you to believe it's because more girls are using contraception. That's why numbers are going down, they'll argue. But if you look around, right, and here's another perspective. Here's one I think holds some truth. If you look around, at least the pro-life movement, you're going to see a lot of young faces, right? Take a look at the March for Life. Take a look at what's happening in social media. There's a decrease in teen sexual activity going on right now, and it's not just here in the States. That's happening around the world. And again, you know, they loathe to admit that that's happening. Right? They loathe to admit that's happening. So I've invited today Michael New to join us. Dr. New is an associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute and a research associate at the Bush School at Catholic University of America. And I hope you'll follow him. You can check him out on Twitter at Michael_J_New. And his last name is N-E-W. And you can also find the Lozier Institute at lozierinstitute.org. It's good to have you back, Doctor. Good afternoon.
Drew, thank you for having me.
That's great news. I love it. You know, so often I have to report on what's happening in the culture, why we need to stand and fight against it and make people aware of the moral implications of it. But, I think evil feeds on itself, and I think evil, anything built on an evil foundation will ultimately collapse. Teen abortions are down significantly, all right? But not abortions among older women. But maybe give us some perspective on the numbers and what we're seeing. What's happening with the teen number and what's happening with this older demographic?
I mean, one thing that I always tell pro-life audiences is that we're making really good progress getting abortion numbers down. I mean, we haven't overturned Roe v. Wade, but abortion rates are falling. And the overall abortion rate has fallen by about 53% since 1980. And that's what we should rejoice, that, a woman of childbearing age today is, in any given year, is half as likely to have had an abortion as her counterpart was back in 1980. But it's not really consistent, or that decline, I should say, is not necessarily consistent among all age demographics. That we're getting abortion numbers down everywhere, but we're seeing the most success and the best success with teenagers. The teen rate, as you said, has fallen by over 82% since 1980. So that's, really good news. I mean, it's good news for several reasons, most importantly because we know that many abortions are repeat abortions. So there's a hope that if we stop the first abortion from happening, we can stop others. So again, we've seen a big decline in the teen abortion rate. It's fallen by over 82%, and there's a variety of reasons for this. First off, we see evidence when teenagers are pregnant, they are more likely to carry that pregnancy to term. That since 1980, the percentage of teen pregnancies carried to term has gone up by 10 percentage points, and the teen pregnancy rate has fallen. Since 1990, the teen pregnancy rate has fallen by 73%. So we're really doing a good job with teenagers, and I think that really bodes well for the future.
That's awesome. That's great news. So what about Planned Parenthood and transgenderism? I hear they're really now beginning to push that. We know they've been on the forefront of pushing contraceptives and abortion. Are they changing their business model at all? Because I think the bottom line in all this, it's really about money. Are they changing their business model to try to ruin more kids' fertility futures? I don't know. I mean, they're definitely anti-life. Give me your perspective on where they are on that issue.
I think we need to pay attention to Planned Parenthood and the, their involvement with, the whole transgender movement. We don't have data on that. I mean, they came with their annual report, and it didn't really mention, transgender quote-unquote treatments. I hate to use that word.
Right.
But anecdotally, we have heard that, more women or more, people or more individuals, I should say, who are gender confused are frankly going to Planned Parenthood, and that Planned Parenthood is seeing this as a potential revenue stream because essentially these hormone treatments, they keep giving them. It's not typically a one-time thing. It's, something that people get repeatedly. And I think we need to be aware of that very often they're administering these treatments to teenagers. Yep. There really may not be proper parental consent. There may not be any real professional counseling. So I think that's something we need to be well aware of.
So, just in terms of strategy, I mean, look, I think this is great news, as I said, when we began overall to see abortion numbers go down. But I also understand how the media works. I mean, the Planned Parenthood understands the power of advertising, marketing, the social media, television. With this new data that's out, they must be looking and saying, hey, what are we doing wrong or why are things changing? Do you expect the abortion industry to change its strategy now and start stepping up campaigns or doing some sort of strategic outreach towards that demographic that's leaving them?
Well, I think that, frankly, they're going to always change strategies, but it's kind of like them, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
I like that.
They are actually concerned, as you mentioned before, that you don't see abortion in popular culture. And I think that's something that they are concerned about. It's very awful when a character in a television show or movie is pregnant and that pregnancy is unintended. Very often it is carried to term. And I think that does concern them, but I also think it does reflect the reality that more and more intended pregnancies, are in fact being carried to term. I think that, you know, one thing you mentioned earlier that's a very positive sign is that there's certainly less sexual activity amongst young people.
Yeah. Why is that?
Contrary to the kind of sex education they promote, you know, more young people are choosing to be chaste.
Well, I think that's concerned to them as well.
Hey,
Dr. News, explain that to me, because we see that in other countries. I've seen the same numbers in Japan and other places. I don't know whether that's driven by the rise of pornography or other things that are taking place, or whether or not, to your point, chastity is resonating. Why are we seeing teens having less sex?
Well, I think there is a variety of reasons for it. I think that, you know, there was a real push toward abstinence-only sex education that started in the late 80s, early 90s. I think that's part of it. You know, I think part of it is just parents, you know, rightfully being concerned. Tragically, I do think pornography probably is a part of it. But I will say these trends started before, like, internet browsers took place. Yeah. We have data that says these declines started in the late 80s, early 90s. And internet browsers did not become consistently used or commonly used until the mid-90s. So the news isn't necessarily all good. You do, I'm sure, see an increase in pornography consumption amongst teens. But again, I do think it's, you know, curricula. You know, I think it's the fact that teenagers are just engaging in kind of less adult activities. They're less likely to date or work for pay or do things.
Yeah.
But the fact that teenagers are less sexually active is good news, and, you know, we should celebrate
Amen
that.
Amen to that. Well, thank you for what you do at the Lozier Institute. And I know people can follow you at LozierInstitute.org. And they can follow you on Twitter. Why don't you do that? You can follow us at Drew Mariani Show and follow Dr. New at Michael_J_New. Check him out there as well. Hey, Doctor, thank you. We'll catch up again soon. I really appreciate your time and your patience.
No, thanks a lot. Enjoyed being on the show.
All right. That's Dr. Michael New, as I said, associate scholar there at the Charlotte Lozier Institute and a research associate there at the Bush School at Catholic University of America, another great institution. All right, we only have a moment or two left. We will pray the chaplet coming up here in a moment. I just want to give you some heads up. There's a new movie out. Well, as we approach Holy Week, and you know, St. Faustina wrote about this. Maybe if I have time, I'll share with you a little bit what she said about the Passion of the Lord. It's so important to meditate on it. She was given visions, actually, of what the Lord went through. And one of the things that really stood out to me and resonated with me is when she saw the scourging of the Lord, his flesh being torn away. And one of the things he suffered for in that scourging was for the sins of impurity. And he just let out this silent moan as he suffered, right? And as we approach Holy Week, and the many saints talked about this, meditating on the Passion of the Lord for an hour is more meritorious than a year of fasting and self-flagellation, you know. They talked about how important this is. There's a film I'd recommend. One, The Passion of the Christ. If you don't have it, get it. Watch it. I think it's a great thing to watch during Holy Week. And really meditate on the Lord's Passion. Pray. And I will share more with you in the days ahead as we approach Holy Week, what the Lord revealed to St. Faustina in his Passion. It's been pretty brutal, and it's very eye-opening. A lot of mystics have also had these encounters. But also, there's a movie coming up. Roma Downey, remember her? She starred in Touched by an Angel. She's got a production company now called Lightworks. They do all sorts of wonderful, really faith-based stuff, and it's well done. They just came out with a new movie. I've been waiting for Mel Gibson to come out with his sequel to The Passion of the Christ on the Resurrection. I think Jim Caviezel is going to be in that, who starred as Christ. She just came out with a film called Resurrection. And to me, it's a no-brainer. I thought somebody should have done this a long time ago. She's going to be stopping by right after we prayed the chaplet. So we'll talk to her about her new campaign. And I'll share with you, too, some proof of the resurrection. This is the source, the summit of our faith. This is what, you know, you and I believe. And if you don't believe that Christ rose from the dead, well, stay with me, okay? I'll give you, I don't know, 7, 8, 9, 10, maybe 15 proofs that Jesus rose from the dead. People are not willing to go to their deaths, you know, be flayed alive, smeared with pitch, and set a light like Nero would do to the early Christians. And he'd light up Christians like they were torches at the night, feed them to lions. They'd be disemboweled and eviscerated. If you didn't really believe that Jesus Christ rose, and Christ did, and he appeared to many, many, the masses saw him. This new film, I think, could inspire you. We'll talk to Roma about that, and we got a lot more coming up. But if you want to join me for the chaplet, I think two lines are open. I know they fill up quickly. I'll do my best to get you on. The number's 888-914-9149. That's good all day, but especially for the chaplet. And, you know, one other thing. I talk about spreading divine mercy. I talk to you about my book. I'm not going to be mentioning that much in the days ahead. they're going to be we're going to be running out of them. So if you haven't gotten it, it's go to relevantradio.com and sign up for it. But tell others, not just about the book, but tell them about the chaplet. Have your loved ones pray with us. When two or more gathered, I believe Christ is present. And we're seeing such unbelievable miracles every day here through this chapel of Divine Mercy. God hears these prayers. His heart is moved. He told St. Faustina, love and mercy itself. This is his greatest attribute. Her spiritual director, who was a great theologian, wasn't sure of whether Faustina was crazy or not, right? And she said that the Lord told her that, you know, mercy was God's greatest attribute. And that was really a deciding factor. He went, he looked at the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas, Augustine, some of these great church fathers and what they had to say, and really came to realize that St. Faustina was being spoken to by Jesus Christ himself. Let's pray the prayer that the Lord himself called the chaplet. One that has called on rain and called off storms, that has worked miracles in the lives of countless, that saves souls from the demonic. We'll pray together when I return.